Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our weekly To Know Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. After a period of feeling things were going in the right direction, in the UK at least, we're going through a patch of worrying news. Excess deaths stand at 65,000, near the top of the international league table. And as we prepare for the reopening of pubs and restaurants this weekend, Leicester has been forced to tighten restrictions again. Sky News is reporting more local lockdowns are expected. The list of businesses making significant cuts is growing daily. Upper Crust and Airbus this morning pointed out the inevitable consequences of what happens when you have such a lockdown limiting travel on their businesses. In a mark of how concerned the government is about the prospects for the economy, Boris Johnson proclaimed himself the heir to Roosevelt with a new deal for Britain, particularly the Midlands and North. Skeptics said the money was relatively paltry, the schemes were rehashed, and anyway, he will struggle to reform the country's national planning rules. The big story overseas is America. The governor of Florida, who mocked the virus's power a few weeks ago, is now finding it is running out of control there, and America is right at the top of the international league tables. But which should we be so gloomy? What are the positives here, and should we be more optimistic? We've got the perfect panel to discuss all of this today. Professor Carol Sikora is one of the leading physicians of his generation. His glittering CV includes being director of the World Health Organization's cancer program. More recently, he's become a bit of a social media sensation and leading commentator on the impacts of COVID-19. Amber Rudd is a regular on these calls and is Teneo senior advisor and a former Home Secretary. She'll be using her usual insight on the political situation in the UK. Claire Enders is the founder of Enders Analysis, the leading media research company in the TMT space. She'll be looking at the impact of COVID-19 on media and tech and the growth of virtualization. And Wolfgang Opickley is co-president of Teneo's risk practice. He'll analyse the trends in handling COVID-19 around the world. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of your screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say again, if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get to it. And Carol Sikora, I'd like to start with you. I've been an avid follower of you on Twitter, which I don't think you'd started until the beginning of this COVID-19 situation. I get the impression reading your tweets, you worry that there's been a bit of an overreaction to this. Is that true?
That's true. The real problem, of course, is where we go now. So the current data, as of this morning, 313,000 people with known infection in Britain, almost certainly the tip of the iceberg. There are almost certainly more that have been infected. And of course, very sadly, nearly 44,000 deaths. Fortunately, both the new infection rate and the death rate is dropping fast. And if we look at the 7-day rolling averages, rather than get excited about little blips and day-to-day counting of both infections and deaths, they're both going in the right direction, which is just fantastic. What's going to happen next? And that's what everybody wants to know. As a doctor, what puzzles me, and I really didn't think it would come to this, I'm an oncologist, I specialize in cancer treatment, I've been an NHS consultant for 40 years, and I've never seen anything like this. What surprises me is the spectrum of disease. So at one end, you've got 50% of people that are definitely infected that have no symptoms at all. They don't even know they're ill. They're not ill. They have no illness. The virus is there. It infects the mucous membranes lining their nose and throat and doesn't cause any damage, doesn't cause any lung damage, no symptoms at all. And yet we know they test positive and they indeed develop immunological reaction to the virus. And at the other end of the disease spectrum, you've got people dying in a critical care unit, unable to get oxygen into their blood because of serious lung pathology that we still don't fully understand. It's not just the virus that causes it, it's the immune reaction to that virus in the depths of the lung, in the little air sacs called alveoli, that causes the lack of oxygen transfer into the blood. And we've heard about happy hypoxia. These are patients that suddenly become blue, their oxygen levels drop precipitously, and yet they're happy. They don't have any symptoms, but they're infected and their lung function is profoundly affected. So that's the problem us medics have in dealing with disease. Fortunately, The NHS coped admirably. It's like a battleship. It turned course and dealt with it fantastically. What it's not so good at is turning back to deal with cancer, heart disease, mental health, and all the other problems we have to deal with. And of course, people are frightened now. So how do we get out of here? What's likely to happen? And I think that's what you all want to know in the harsh world of business. How's it going to end up? So as always, there are those that are optimistic and those that are pessimistic. So my optimistic scenario is we're going to see small problems like Leicester. The reasons are not clear. And there will be other places where we'll have the same. Can we deal with them effectively in Britain? We're not as good as Germany. We're not going to seal off apartment blocks. We're not going to have police blocking the roads and so on. People can still take a train to Leicester from St. Pancras this morning and vice versa the other way around. That's the harsh reality of public health. It's intrusive on society. It has to be. And countries that have a military police type structure, a military police sort of ability to control society and much more subservience in its population will do better under that. Nevertheless, it seems reasonable what's happening, and it seems a compromise between a harsh quarantine situation for Leicester and other areas. So that's likely to happen, but it gradually will get infrequent, and then by the end of, say, August, everything will be calm again and it will all disappear. And the NHS will switch back to the diseases it's supposed to be treating instead of COVID. So that's the optimistic scenario. The pessimistic scenario, beloved by the epidemiologists, because obviously if the virus just peters out through the summer, they peter out too. We no longer need their expertise. Thank you. That's it. The virus is gone. So they have a vested interest in claiming there's going to be a second peak in September, which will run into winter pressures in our hospitals, which will make the NHS grind to a halt again. It'll require the activation of the Nightingale hospitals as ventilatory centres for lung damage, and everything will be back into lockdown. So that's the most gloomy. Obviously, as with all prognoses, that's somewhere in between. I suspect it's going to be nearer my scenario, my optimistic scenario. When you look at other countries that came out of this mess some time back, Austria, Czech Republic, Norway and Denmark, they came out roughly at the same time, 13th, 14th of April, just the week after Easter. And they've done all right. Austria, there's a little blip at the moment, a few cases more than you'd like to see, but it looks okay. And Germany, we've heard about the Gütersloh abattoir, which is probably as much about working conditions and living conditions of a relatively poor migrant workforce than the reality of German society. So all these things need control. It has put public health in the fore. You know, my last understanding of the R0 that we've heard about, the reproduction number, came 50 years ago when I was a medical student in Cambridge. So I had to get my books out to see what the R0 was. There's no doubt that most doctors are unfamiliar with it. And now we're all familiar. Everybody, even my grandchildren, my six-year-old granddaughter, knows what an R0 is and can explain it to me, which I find fascinating. How do we get out of this? We have to trust public health and we have to trust it moving us forward. There's no easy solution. At the same time, Saturday, the pubs and industry will open up in a much freer way. We've got to get rid of the fear that the powerful slogan that we had at the beginning has to go and be replaced with a different one of probably not even staying alert. I'm not sure what I'm looking for. My dog stays alert for me, you know. I don't do it myself because I'm not sure what I'm looking for. But as we move out of this, I think society will gradually get back to normal. Just to finish off, you know, I've been reading books about previous pandemics. It's fascinating, including the Great Plague, the bubonic plague, the plagues in Rome. You know, the word quarantine actually comes from 40 days, 40 giorni in Italian, because Venice in the 14th century actually imposed a ban for 40 days on any boats coming into the harbour. They had to wait outside and then the sanitary inspector would see if there were any plague cases. You know, that sort of strategy is very much 600 years later we're still using a similar strategy, which is quite fascinating, but important. So I'd be very interested to hear what the others have to say and how you think it's going to impact on the economy as a whole. Thank you.
Yes, I'm talking on mute. That was the, I was wondering why you were holding your hand to your chat. Having told everybody to make sure they're off mute, I was on mute. Anyway, you were saying about the health situation, Carol. Let's move it to the economy. Amber, you and I are talking a lot to people about what's going on with the economy and government. I spoke to a few people at Number 10 last week. I know you have too. And reading between the lines of what they're saying, this Boris speech earlier in the week, there's a Rishi Sunak one next week, it feels like they are more worried than they have ever been about the economy. Do you think that's right?
That's absolutely true. The big concern now is about being about having high levels of unemployment, and all the government effort is really moving away from the health area to the economy. And I mean, the messaging is moving away as well. And of course, by not having those daily briefings, which were getting incredibly painful for government to have to deliver, they at least have bought themselves some space to be able to change that topic of conversation. But boy, are they going to have to move quickly now to get ahead of this growing wave of unemployment figures being announced. I recall in February 2019 when Honda in Swindon announced closures for 2021, and there were going to be 3,500 people losing their jobs. And we mobilised the whole of the DWP department to go down there to support people losing their jobs. It was lead news. That was 3,500 jobs. Today, over 5,000 job losses have been announced, and there's been a sharp intake of breath. But we're going to be normalising really over the next few weeks, few months, those job losses, and government is going to be in real trouble trying to get ahead of that. What we saw today was, to use two examples, Airbus and Upper Crust. You know, one where there's no movement in terms of train stations, and the other where people are just not going to be flying as much. And it's very easy to look at the other areas where there's just going to be less activity and therefore less requirement. Added to that, the Chancellor has had to signal the end of furlough over the next few months. And that, of course, gives companies the opportunity to go through the right routine of sending people out letters saying that they're going to be made redundant. And that's why we're going to see it escalating in July. I saw that the CBI head, Carolyn Fairbairn, called today for extension of furlough, perhaps in some sectors, perhaps reduced over a longer period. I don't see that happening. I think the government has made up its mind now that it's got to look ahead to the future. It's set out the terms of the furlough ending and is gritting its teeth ahead of the job losses and is trying to provide an alternative. And of course, with Boris's speech yesterday, build, 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 he's signalling there's going to be some major investment in infrastructure. There's a lot more to hear about that. You know, how green will it be? I mean, there's a sort of a lobbing out comments that it might be green. It's still unclear whether he will revisit the Swansea Tidal Lagoon, quite how that money will be spent. There's a good sign there's going to be money spent on education and on a jobs guarantee, a jobs opportunity guarantee for young people. But there's lots more to see on that as well. So yes, next week the Chancellor is going to be making his announcement. And his aim is going to be to get people spending quickly. Of the 9 million jobs that have been furloughed, 3 million are in retail and hospitality. So he needs people to get out there and start spending in retail and in hospitality, such places that are open, so that those people in those jobs don't start to lose their jobs in the sort of scale that could otherwise be seen. So it's going to be spend safely over summer so that people do go out and actually spend some of their money. Trouble is that the more he emphasizes that, the more nervous people will be about the future and less likely to spend it overall. The other quite interesting thing in terms of the government position is this signal that there's going to be a reduction in planning regulations. Now, we've looked at this before, and it's true that Conservative governments always think they can do this and then run into the politics against it. But I feel that there is a kind of seriousness about this and a story coming through that means they really are going to try to take on the Conservative MPs to see if they can get a change to planning. Of course, it's a cost-free stimulus changing planning. And you can really wrap that up in the need, the very clear need to build more houses as well. So I'm reasonably optimistic that we may see some significant changes on that, which will really fold nicely into the building, reducing planning, and being a country that takes the opportunity to employ people in good jobs in terms of building better safely and greener. The politics that we saw over the last week were the usual dramas, which we've become to expect with this government, with the Perm Secretary and National Security Advisor, one person, effectively being ousted, Mark Sedwill, who really was a marked card by Boris and Dominic from the moment they came in. He has surprised people, Boris, by appointing David Frost to the National Security Advisor role, not a man who has any experience in the security brief, something that Theresa May pointed out with absolute fury in the House of Commons yesterday, which actually made the very fluent Michael Gove stumble slightly in his response. But, you know, we are seeing a situation at the moment where whatever the government seems to do that seems outside the ordinary, they just plough on and achieve it. So I don't think there's going to be any change to that. It'll be interesting to see who's appointed permanent secretary. But otherwise, the juggernaut moves on nervously, anxiously about the economy and about employment, but with the free hand to spend money and to change planning, which is where I think the most interesting changes are going to take place.
Thanks, Amber. That's fascinating. I mean, the received wisdom of the political class is that this government's going to come a cropper all the time. And as you say, they haven't quite yet. So it'll be interesting to see at what point that actually happens, if at all. But anyway, let's move from the health and economy onto the specific here. Claire, one of the persistent themes of this call has been accelerated trends. And you're seeing that definitely in terms of media and tech. Can you just unpack that a bit for us?
I mean, what we're really seeing is, in economic terms, paradigm shifts and fundamental behavioral shifts. I think the first, you know, optimistic and happy thing to say, possibly the only one I can say today, is that our telecoms infrastructure has actually delivered the effective ability for 80% of our GDP to survive. So that is the new normal. It is going to continue for a long time to come, as I know from being on these calls, many companies have in fact shut their physical operations, and we are in a completely new way of working, which is semi-permanent and certainly long-term certainly in the next 3 years. Anything to do with the virus is going to impact corporate behavior on a very significant scale, fundamental. The permanent virtualization of our world has in fact, on an economic side, really only benefited Google, Facebook, gaming companies, Netflix on the media side, Zoom and Microsoft and others on the work front, and obviously Amazon rising supreme on the e-commerce side. E-commerce in the UK has leapt to 30% in the last quarter. It is the highest in Europe already and was before, but this is again a paradigm shift as people feel enormous sense of fear from going outside their homes. On the media side, streaming has increased 100%. Now, that's comprised of very large global phenomena. YouTube, Netflix, Disney Plus, Epic Games have all stimulated massivation of schooling, whilst many furlough hours have also gone on these highly immersive, extremely attractive media, many of them which are not governed by anything but self-regulation. So how have our own British media fared? Well, number 10 went into 2020 determined to, at the very least, completely restructure public service broadcasting in general and the BBC and Channel 4 in particular. But the importance of public service broadcasting has been demonstrated by the impact of the public health crisis and on people's consumption, massively increased of news, massively increased of information. And so we have seen a restoration of that importance, but only in news as a result of the crisis. So audiences rose 25% during the lockdown, which, as I said, compared to the 100% rise in streaming, is started to tail off as news has become less important. Now, the BBC is still in peril until a new chair is appointed and its 2022 and 2027 settlement is sorted in Q1 2021. It has actually put off, thank God, sending 4.5 million letters to the over 75s, to inform that they will now pay something. It has also forestalled this because the DWP would clearly fall over from mass increases in claims, and over a million people in this 4.5 million over 75s group would not be able to read the letter or understand it. So this is something that I have campaigned very actively with the BBC for them to understand, that this would also have a very negative impact on consumption of news, because, you know, obviously over 75s would cut the amount of money they spend on newspapers, books, and other forms of very, very important activities for them. So but in essence, the impact on the commercial PSBs has been a massive decline in advertising last quarter, reaching 50% for Channel 4, ITV, over so the whole sector as a whole. Obviously, a mirror of more than a mirror of GDP drop of around 20%, plus the virtualization of things, the move to e-commerce, the move away from stores. But they learned the lesson in the 2000 Great Recession, and they will survive this phase. Although, of course, the impact on the independent production sector of a suspension of drama, of an 18-month difficulty in starting up production, has been catastrophic. I think Lord Davies on a previous call mentioned the impact on sports, also very difficult. Theatre, all of this milieu, we can really see, and I've spent 20 years working on the growth of the creative economy, and we've seen, it appears, 20 years of growth wiped out in 3 months. However, the most significant impact on the fabric of our democracy has been on the print industry, where we are expecting mass redundancies to follow the termination of the furlough scheme. And the loss of weekly sales, this is the Monday to Friday sales, has been catastrophic for many titles. And that will combine with the the difficulty of taking public transport. It has turned out that commuters support those weekly sales. And we've also seen a 50% drop in advertising, which may well worsen. This is a true paradigm shift towards digital media. And that is why we are still in very, very perilous situation. Government action to support the media has been very slight by comparison with efforts in Italy, Germany, all over the place, all over Europe. There is a fundamental understanding that a cultural intervention like public service broadcasting, in fact, public service broadcasting itself, is fundamental to the support of education, of our values, of our own milieu, and for it to recreate what was a success story that grew by 10% a year for the last decade. And this is my deepest wish, is that we can somehow get to the other side and see growth again. Thank you very much.
Claire, that was really fascinating. Wolf, I'd like to turn to you just before we come to the questions and really sort of start you off about America. You were talking to me earlier about the stock market there going gangbusters. And yet it's in real trouble in a lot of states. You know, Texas and Florida really hit the news in the last couple of weeks here. Talk us through that.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of interesting disconnects. There is a disconnect between what's going on in the equity market and the real economy, a disconnect between what is going on in the US equity market and the real life, especially in terms of public health. So let me try to unpack this a bit. So when we look at the last quarter, the second quarter this year, we had the data now. It was the best quarter for the U.S. stock market in 21 years. When we look at the real economy, it was the worst quarter on record. So there is a clear disconnect between the equity bubble, which is obviously deeply inflated by the stimulus put together by both the Fed and the Treasury, and the real economy. Then when we turn to the public health front, the news are bad. We discussed already that last week. Last week, we were up 30% in terms of cases. Well, we are up now 80%. And it's not, last week, we were discussing about 5-6 states where we had seen a spike. Now we are at 17 states. Yesterday, the US registered 47,000 new positive cases. This is the highest figure since the crisis started. We have now more than 2.6 million positive cases, and so on. So clearly, big trouble. In Florida alone, just to put things into perspective, they had 2 days ago more than 9,000 cases. Italy, at its peak, had 6,000. So we are talking about Florida against Italy here, just to put things into perspective. So it's a big struggle. What is actually interesting, that the whole issue has become extremely politicized, in the sense, if there is a lesson learned from this crisis, at least from somebody coming from a political perspective, in terms of succeeding here, there were two main components in the study that we have seen. First, the ability of the state to put together quickly a testing system, tracing, isolating, and so on. So there is a technical aspect. But the second one is a buy-in by the people, a buy-in that you can at times incentivize with rules, but generally you try to do that with a sense of trust, a clear debate, trusting the scientists, and so on. In the US, we are going in the opposite direction, where even wearing the mask becomes a political expression. So the whole rationality has been thrown out of the window here, mainly because of the president's and the ongoing campaign, and this had a huge impact in terms of the buy-in that you require when you are trying to move away from this dire situation. That is where we are. Bringing a bit closer to home, and maybe associated to the case of Leicester, we discussed last week about the outbreak in Germany, in the largest meat plant facility in the country. What we look at there was some of the ingredients that allowed the authorities to tackle it and move quickly and contain it, even if they had to extend for another week the lockdown. It was extended on Monday, but we haven't seen at least a spread of cases. What really made the difference in Germany is the local authorities, meaning that even when the meat plant owner, a very well-known billionaire, was not particularly cooperative, the authorities went in and they were able to have all the necessary data within 24 hours, and they used the data then to take the other steps, which didn't involve blocking freedom of movement, by the way. It didn't. That required a strong ability to test, trace, and isolate. And that was done by the local authority, who also have the power to legislate on these kind of matters. When we look at the situation in Leicester, these kind of ingredients seems to be missing, to the point that even yesterday the health secretary was suggesting that unnecessary additional legislation might be needed to tackle this local outbreak. So here, again, they seem to be a bit behind the curve. And let me stop there.
Thanks, Wolf. That's really some fascinating things, particularly the disconnect, as you say, between what's going on in the stock markets and the real economy in America. And we'll come to that in a moment. I want to remind people that there's the chat function at the top right hand of the screen. Do send in your questions, some good ones coming in already. But first, Carol, I just want to come to you. I'm confused, Carol, maybe you can help me understand this. There seems to be some suggestion that COVID-19 is not as powerful as it once was. And yet you're looking at situations in Leicester, Texas, Florida, and it seems out of control. Why are you still so optimistic given that?
So basically, if you look at all the curves, they are petering out. The incidence curve is the key. The other key that we have in Britain that's quite unique to us is NHS 111 telephony data and online data. So people phone this non-urgent service, unlike 999, which is the ambulance service. They phone 111 to get advice. It's a computer algorithm driven response, and that allows you to collect very good quality data. It seems old fashioned to do this. It's like the sort of medicine I was taught when I was a student. You listen to the patient, you listen to what the problems are, and of course the computer's coding it as the operator is talking to the patient. So you have a huge database now. And if you look at it, that too is following very closely ahead of the incidence. So in other words, you can see before the virus tests positive, you get the symptoms coming in most patients or around the same time. So you can compare the data from 111, rather like putting a canary down the mine, you can find out what's going on. So that's very useful in Britain.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but just talk me through this point that we were discussing when we were preparing for school. You were saying that the number of people going into hospital and dying at the beginning of this outbreak was quite high and is now much less. Just explain that a bit.
So exactly that. It looks as though studies from Italy, which is a bit further ahead than us in this whole journey, showed that the patients now being infected with the virus have less virus load, they have less copies of the RNA from the virus on their body. And that is hopeful because that suggests the virus is going around infecting people but not causing so much damage. Is it mutating? There's not much evidence of that because that would be a disaster in terms of vaccine production if the virus starts to change its coat, basically, because it would mean the vaccine wouldn't work in the mutated virus. So as we move on, I think it's much more likely that the virus will peter out. And that's how other pandemics work. The pathogen and the host, I've compared them to dancers. You know, they're dancing in the night and they're getting slower to dance with each other. The host has changed, that's us, has changed its behavior pattern. All know what society's been through, and the virus is changing its behavior pattern. The host and pathogen, any parasite really wants peace with its host because it wants to stay forever. And in a sense, SARS has done that, and MERS, the two other coronaviruses before COVID-2, which is obviously COVID-19, came along. They've learned to live with us. And this is what I believe this virus is trying to do. I tried to engage the theological people about does the virus have a soul, but they didn't want to go down that route. It was too complex for them to go.
Feels like
So.
a tangent even for us, Carol. But I do want to bring in David Boyd's question from AstraZeneca here. He's essentially, and Amber, I'd like to bring you in on this as well as Carol. It's basically he's pointing to the fact that there are so many people who are not being tested for cancer at the moment. And what impact is that going to have on them long term? And that's, of course, is just one field of medicine. So Amber, there's a political side to this, isn't there? We think that upwards of 5 million people are going to be on waiting lists and they're going to extend dramatically. Can you talk to that just before I bring Carol back in?
Yes, I mean, I think it's a time bomb, really, isn't it? And I saw that Jeremy Hunt at his Health Select Committee yesterday addressed exactly that problem and concluded in his sort of diplomatic way that the NHS had coped well up to now, but there was going to be an explosion of need as people came out of the lockdown and actually were able to go and seek the help that they needed. So I do think it's a huge problem, yes.
And Carol, you know, as somebody who spent your life dedicated to helping people with cancer, how worrying is that?
I think it's going to be a real challenge. Every month, 30,000 people present with cancer in the UK. That's the standard number. It's unlike COVID, it doesn't go down. There's no peaks and no troughs. It's 30,000 a month, winter and summer. And we know from pathology labs around the country, the total number of cancer biopsies for the month of May were less than 5,000. And for the month of June, which has just come to an end, are still way below that 30,000 level. So clearly, we've got a problem and we have to deal with it. Everyone's talking about how to deal with it because not only do we have non-diagnosed cancer, but the patients that are going to be diagnosed, they're all going to come at once. We suspect in August and September, they're all going to come up for treatment then. And although the NHS has done remarkably well with COVID, it's struggling to get back to normal business. And that's partly the fear. It's partly the fear of patients and general practice and in secondary care. And we've got to overcome that to get back to a semblance of normal. And that's the main aim now, to undiscover these cancer patients and get the covert cancers to the fore and get started on treatment schedules.
And Claire, there's a theme here that's related that in your line of work, which is you were talking about virtualization, and medicine is one of those fields where we've seen a lot more virtualization during this period, which essentially is what we're doing, talking to people through computer screens. Can you talk to that, starting with medicine, and maybe how that's flushing out through the rest of the economy?
I mean, there's definitely been a massive increase in telemedicine, and obviously, you know, we're also trying to cope with teleworking probably better than we are teleschooling, given the massive evasion of schooling, which has been such a concern to so many people who are observing the social repercussions, and obviously the virtualization of health is also a virtualization of schooling requires high levels of equipment, and we know that that remains very unsatisfactory, particularly among much poorer people, children, and of course older people who are very ill-equipped for telemedicine and have been in the longest period of lockdown. So it is something that, again, we're seeing seized upon by the middle class, the upper middle class, which is supporting GDP, but extraordinarily difficult for those on the other side of the digital divide to cope, and even more so in future, to my mind. Although behavioral change is possible, it is very difficult for over 75s to cope with.
Thank you. Wolf, just looking at the States again, Joe Biden came out and gave a speech basically accusing Trump of being completely reckless in terms of COVID-19 and clearly thinks he's on to a winner in terms of the politics of this. Do you think that's right? Is that cutting through, or is it another case of Trump's base just refusing to engage with that kind of thing?
I think it's too early to say, in the sense that, yes, Biden came out, but the best strategy of Biden has been so far the one of keeping silent. When you have somebody who is committing suicide and has got a gun in his head, you don't need to put another gun. So too early to say. In the polls, clearly, Trump is struggling, but we know the nationwide polls do not really matter. They're actually misleading in terms of the U.S. It is, for me, there are two variables between now and November, which I think could make a difference here and potentially help Trump. First, can he reopen the schools? Can they reopen the schools at the end of August or not? If they can, it looks difficult now, but if they can, I think is an important one. Second is the economy, because it tanked so much in terms of real economy that it has to bounce back. And I'm sure that he will exploit that bounce back, even if it could be just temporary one, to argue that the worst is over here. So it's a bit of a mixed picture. Also, the other surprise card that I think I wouldn't be surprised if Trump uses it is the idea of a vaccine. I wouldn't be surprised at all if in October, ahead of the 3rd of November vote, suddenly Trump starts suggesting that US companies have managed to achieve a vaccine that sometime in 2021 will be delivered and so on. So what I'm trying to say here, if you hear no, news about a vaccine coming from Trump in October, let's take it with a big pinch of salt.
And Amber, what Wolf was saying there about the schools reopening, that's becoming totemic in lots of democracies around the world about can you actually get the schools back and functioning properly. Is there any doubt that we will reopen the schools in a major way in September? And if not, if there is, how much of a problem is there for Boris Johnson?
I think it would be a huge problem. I mean, it's really settled in people's consciousness, as Wolf was saying, that the schools, and Claire was saying actually, the business of the schools not opening will be hurting the people at the bottom of society the most. And the urgency has now picked up. I mean, government's just been a bit late about it, but the fact that they really need to reopen them in September, or they will be letting down a whole generation effectively, not just a year group, because it hits so many people, has really landed. So I'm pretty sure they will reopen September, because they'll be throwing so much activity at it. But if we see too many events like Leicester, they certainly won't open in those sort of places. If there are regional areas that get locked down, they will not open the schools. So it'll depend on having a reasonably positive summer.
And while we're on that subject, Amber, there's a question from Debbie Howard here. Interested in your views on government spending on schools. Is there an infrastructure need for schools? Build. Or most school children still not back at school, that kind of thing. So basically, we saw earlier in the week, didn't we, that there is going to try, they're going to try and spend a bit on school infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean that's great. That's always very welcome. Some of the, particularly the larger secondary schools, are in a terrible state. But I'm with the questioner here, really. I would be spending money on the teachers and on the training rather than on the infrastructure. But of course, the infrastructure is more appealing because it's sort of politically, it feels more symbolic. You can demonstrate what you've actually built, but the real need, I think, is in reassuring the teachers, quite a powerful union as they've shown, and making sure that the pupils who've missed out get the extra training and teaching that they need.
And Carol and Amber, this Saturday we're going to see pubs reopening. There's quite a few people worried about that because they think that there's going to be a sudden splurge on a Saturday night of people out there and worried about the police and A&E. With your NHS hat on, Carol, are you worried about Saturday night? And Amber, do you think, with this former Home Secretary, do you think we should be worried that Saturday night suddenly the great British binging culture will be unleashed?
You know, I hope people behave themselves. I mean, it is part of the British culture you don't see in mainland Europe. You know, Spain, Italy, Germany. You know, of course they have football hooligans, and of course people do get drunk, but not in the same way that we see here. And, you know, the liberation on a Saturday could be questioned. Why not do it on a Monday when, you know, everything could open up in an organised way and people will go back to work? And then, you know, you don't have a single day, the Super Saturday concept, which I think we'll cope with it. I think the idea that somehow the emergency service will shut down and get overwhelmed is unlikely. There will be increased police activity, I'm sure, and it'll be a challenge. But as always, it'll be coped with admirably well in a very British way.
Amber, was it wise to do it on a Saturday?
I'm less optimistic, I'm afraid. The so-called nighttime economy, which is what the hospitality call it, which makes the police forces across the nations wince with agony. You know, when people go out to get drunk and they stay at the, you know, they stay drunk Friday night, Saturday night, quite late into the night, and they also go out to have sometimes to have a bit of fun, which involves a bit of violence, a bit of sort of, you know, group hanging around, and it is a nightmare for police. And the fact that it's going to be unleashed on a Saturday, I think, is absolute madness. All of it unleashed on a Saturday. And when you combine that with the fact that we have seen some pretty unpleasant displays of aggression towards our police, not just over the Black Lives Matter protests, but also in a sort of occasional community protests where perhaps there's been an illegal rave going on or big groups meeting. And the police have encountered some really nasty and, in a way, Carol, un-British approach to the usual policing by consent that we've seen over the past few years and is what sort of characterises British policing. So I am concerned. I am concerned that I think it's a mistake to do it on this Saturday.
Alien attitude towards drinking. I'm just going to switch it over to Claire. Claire, I was interested in what you were saying about print sales going through the floor. Even though that's been a trend for quite a long time, print media has dictated a lot of the debate in this country. They've set the terms of it. It has a deep impact on, you know, how public service broadcasters cover things and that kind of thing. How significant do you think that is in terms of the way the debate is carried out and where people get their news from and how that debate is structured?
Well, I mean, we're going to see a negative impact from any decline in the number of journalists who are processing information or looking into anything on the local space. So the local media in particular are facing the most significant redundancies. The FT is taking a 20% pay cut. You know, many organizations are fighting for their survival. And those that are sheltered are The Guardian and the FT in particular. Obviously News UK is very sheltered, even though the weekly sales have been down very, very badly. I need to point out, however, the weekend sales have recovered to about what they were before the levels, showing that people really do appreciate print media when they can get it. But the weekly sales have gone down and permanently, and obviously, and the dependency on commuting was revealed inevitably. So in terms of reporting, I think there has been an increasing bravery, particularly from News UK, in tackling issues that they feel are in the public interest. They were, as we know, you know, very, very strong Boris supporters for a very long time, and they have reacted with great responsibility. I think in perhaps more so in the last few weeks than before, as it became manifest. I think that the Mail has also found its feet at last in terms of really understanding that the millions of people who are viewing material online, in particular the Sun and the Mail having, and the Guardian and the FT, have very, very strong online one. Much of it, this is free accessible to people. We've also seen massive increases, obviously, in Facebook activity and exchange of information. And people are searching. The amount of news consumption, information consumption has simply rocketed so high that you're seeing a very desperate population trying to reassure itself or find ways of reassuring itself. And obviously, the importance of this is manifested by the fact that we've seen the same system collapse in France around parliament, around scrutiny. So we need to hang on to our democracy by hanging on to our media.
Yeah. And Wolf, I'm interested in the UK. It's pretty clear that the British government has now moved its focus really from health towards the economy in terms of the Boris speech this week, what Rishi Sunak is going to do next week. There are hints that there may be a significant cut in VAT, at least in the short to medium term. Are we seeing that evidence in other countries around the world, or is it something that is particular to the UK? How worried are they?
Yeah, let me first make a point on the UK. Well, when we look at his new deal announced yesterday, it's not new, it's not a deal. The new deal was 40% of US output. The 5 billion is 0.2% of UK GDP. So the number is a joke. We look at the design of the deal. It looked like it's something to tackle the failures of the first industrial revolution, and we are certainly not there at this point. So that overall, I don't think there was much new yesterday. Yes, the concern is there. This cut of this VAT cut is being discussed in a variety of countries, including Italy. The problem is that VAT cuts usually don't work, or if they work, they don't work for the consumer, but they, in best case scenario, they might work for the business, in the sense that the VAT cut discount is not passed to the consumer and so on. They're extremely expensive to cut the VAT in Italy by 1 percentage point from the 22 standard to 21 for 1 year is 4 billion. As you can understand, a cut of 1% will not make a difference to anybody. So you need something more substantial. So like, if you start cutting VAT in the economy the size of Italy and the UK by 5-6 percentage points, you end up in bills of 20-30 billion very, very quickly. And the evidence so far, it doesn't suggest that actually really helps that much. What really helps, especially in an environment where we're going to see more unemployment, is active labor policies, retraining of people mainly, cutting the cost of labor, which is a big issue in continental Europe, not so much in the UK, rather than VAT cuts. The crunch time in most European countries, September, October, because that is when most of the existing shock absorbing schemes are coming to an end. In some countries in Europe, there is also a ban on layoff, which will expire by in August, September, depending on the countries. The touristic season for some countries is crucial, and we know it's not going to go very well. So that the September, October year will be a bit of a crunch time in lots of countries, and also a crunch time in terms of ability to reopen the schools and so on. One point about opening schools, which I think we should be clear, is not going to be a neat process. I give you my example. My daughter is back at school. One girl in class had fever on a Saturday. The school was closed on Monday, waiting for the results. Once we get into September, October, November with the normal seasonal problems, what are we going to do each time one of the students, pupils, has got fever? Are we going to shut down the class, the school? Are we waiting for the test? So just to give you a, so just to make it clear that here we are not talking about a linear process.
So that's fascinating. So that's a good point to bring Carol back in here. The BBC is reporting that there's a new flu virus with pandemic potential in China. There's also just the reality of in winter people get colds and flu. Bearing in mind what Wolf was just saying there about how people suddenly coming down with these symptoms, and should we be worried about this new suggestion about what's going on in China? Is it going to become a confusing pattern when normal winter flu and cold things come through?
To be honest, we just don't know. We need better ways of testing to get rid of this problem. As you know, we've just heard, if one girl in his class gets a fever, that doesn't mean there's coronavirus there. We need to understand it quickly. And luckily, there are some new tests about to be launched, which involve instant readouts from saliva, which is a lot simpler than putting sticks up your nose or in the back of your throat. And the saliva test is just a mouthwash and can be done within an hour at the point of care. So point of care testing is coming. And you know, that will help sort this problem out. I guess temperature sensors are now going to be familiar in many public places, but more importantly, access to quick tests. No test is perfectly reliable. That's the problem we have, but it does give you an idea. And it will stop this this huge shutdown that happens with one person getting some sort of fever. Fever is going to be common in children at school in winter. It's sort of inevitable, and that's what we have to face, have to sort it out.
Now, a couple of quick questions from our audience. Simon Greaves from Harwood Levitt is saying, what does Carol think of the repurposing of Nightingale hospitals as diagnostic treatment centres? Is there a radically different model as claimed yesterday? And Lucinda Kenny is asking a different question. I've been told that many surgeons, doctors can't see patients because of the lack of PPE. What is your view on this? Is it still as big a problem as people have been saying?
The Nightingale hospitals are interesting. They were built for a different purpose, and we have to keep them for that purpose in case there's a second wave that I don't believe will happen. We have to have them there, that's clear. Can they be repurposed for cancer? It's actually quite difficult to do that. They have diagnostic capabilities. Some of them have a CT scan. You could certainly put a van with a scan in the back of them. So it's possible to use them for that. And the Exeter one seems to have already been committed to a cancer screening centre, which is great. It's a good idea. How this all unfolds depends on what happens next with the virus. If you believe my optimistic scenario, we can get back to normal within the confines of an NHS hospital service. If we don't get back to normal, then we're going to have to do everything we can to get people with illnesses other than COVID sorted out. And so I think we just have to wait and see what happens. But I'm optimistic we can get normal service running. But again, it does tie in with the last point. We do need better ways to screen people for the virus so we don't contaminate areas and we keep people out. We have COVID-free zones in the hospital.
Thanks, Claire. Tim Burt from Tenneo is asking a question, saying that the COVID crisis has exposed wide differences in social well-being, ethnic vulnerability, and economic impacts from the lockdowns. Extremist content hosted by social media platforms has magnified discontent at these disparities. And of course, we're seeing what's going on with businesses refusing to advertise on Facebook. You know, there's this current advertising boycott going on. How much change are we going to see in those areas because of all of that?
We're not going to see any change in the increased dominance of global tech giants, for that is a phenomenon of the last 25 years. It is now unstoppable, and there you are. I think that the impact of waves of public impact, campaigns, that is something that we've seen very, very strongly to the fore. The Marcus Rashford issues, reopening the zoos, which I was involved with, which happened in 24 hours when Boris was knocked over by Stanley Johnson. These are things that actually work. I think active campaigning and active activism from the Sun or extraordinarily well-organized group, but particularly from established media, whatever they are going to be very effective in this space. I mean, we've seen number 10 effectively fall over several times, and I think we'll see a lot more impact on companies of anything that is thought untoward in terms of socially acceptable behaviors and values. We are living in a world of heightened interest and massive increases of media consumption give people a sense of engagement and involvement in so many different elements. And of course, that's been very positive because Age UK has survived because of public giving. And so there's a very positive element to this very, very strong engagement in causes and a real understanding that many things are not going to be solved by anybody but the public. I think that's a very good thing to come to this country at last.
Yeah. And Amber, I just want to come back to this point that a huge part of Boris's strategy seems to be that he can get a lot of projects underway, a lot of spending ongoing, that kind of thing. The reality is anybody who's been in government knows that there's a reality of judicial review and planning laws in this country. And Conservative backbenchers are the biggest NIMBYs in the whole world, really. They don't like stuff being built in their areas, that kind of thing. Is he going to really be so easily able to just wipe that aside, get some legislation through, or do you think it's a bit more complicated than that?
He's going to have to get some legislation through in order to do what he's seeking to do, i.e. reduce planning legislation as part of the fiscal stimulus. I don't underestimate the difficulty of that, but I think that he's made it so central to what he's going to try and do that he will get it through. But I mean, we'll have to wait and see what he actually says. But reading between the lines, it's in a way, it's skipping planning permission for something that has already been allowed, but with planning permission. So it's transferring the use from shops to homes, that sort of thing. You can do that now, but you have to sort of run it through.
Well, under the previous Prime Minister, you saw a situation, she was giving a speech one day about why we need to build hundreds of thousands of houses a year. And the next day, she was part of plans to block it in her own Maidstone constituency. Yeah. I mean, it does bring out the schizophrenic in Conservative MPs.
No, it's definitely an issue, and you're right to highlight it. And the experience of the past 10 years has been exactly that. But on the basis that things have changed now, I think that coming out of this pandemic, that is one thing that will have changed. But can I also just endorse just what Claire said, which I think is so interesting, is that public have mobilised themselves much more than they have been when I was in government, really, to make sure that they participate in influencing government. I mean, we had occasional things when, you know, budget announcements were made about, you probably bear the scars as I do, Craig, about pasties or about caravans, which had to lead to U-turns. But this feels different, that they are sort of, they've learned how to use social media en masse in terms of campaigning, and that that could be the biggest block to some of the decisions that government is going to try and get through.
Okay, we've got less than 2 minutes to go, so I'm going to come back to a familiar question on these calls, which is about optimism versus pessimism. I've heard lots of optimistic messages, I've heard lots of pessimistic messages. Can you just each say which side you veer on and why in less than 30 seconds each? So, Carol, let's start with you.
So I'm optimistic. I'm positive about this. I think we have to be. I mean, there are some gloomy things out there. The United States, Latin America are perhaps the gloomiest parts of the world. But if you look how this has developed, it started in Asia and it moved across to Europe. It flew first class on the aeroplanes, I'm sure, and has ended up in Latin America and North America. Everybody's handled it differently, different levels of oppression on society. And when this is all over, we'll be able to analyse all the results. There'll be fascinating epidemiological information. But I think it is coming to an end. The countries that have come out of it in Asia and Europe seem to be doing okay. There are localised outbreaks, there are problems, there are going to be those. But we are getting on top of it. How it ends in the Americas remains to be seen. But there too, it's got to come to an end at some point. And from the past pandemics, the only end when society gets over it and says they're over, we're carrying on our normal lives. And that's the difficulty. How do we know when this is coming to an end? I saw with interest that the Czech Republic is planning a party on the bridge, the famous Charles Bridge over the river in Prague on Saturday. That's their way of doing a super Saturday. How it really works out, I just don't know.
Wolf, in a sentence.
I don't think there is a neat pattern of beginning and end of pandemic, especially when you look at the political, socio-economic impact. I think it goes on for a very long time. And lots of this pandemic, actually, they never ended. They were just socially accepted. Think about, you know, polio, how long it took. And think about tuberculosis still. We have more than 10 million cases a year. Nobody's discussing about that. And we have 1.5 million people dying every year of tuberculosis.
Claire, a sentence from you.
So I'm very positive because we've seen the advertising economy and advertisers fight like hell for 80% of GDP, as much as they used to for 100. So that is a sign of growth. and possibilities. The BBC has survived so far and is keeping away from the worst of its possibilities. And I think that we are seeing as Amber and I both agree, a massive rush for people to actually own institutions and care about them. And that is going to be a very positive development.
And Amber, a last word from you.
I'm optimistic about the health because, as Carol set out, people's behaviour has changed. So I think that'll have a lasting impact on whether people actually get the virus and hopefully making sure that it leaves our communities. I'm less optimistic, I have to say, about government. They still prize obedience over ability. And I think that's a very worrying trend.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much. It's been another brilliant panel. We always try to do a sort of a virtual round of applause. So if you can imagine it, panelists, Carol Sikora, Wolf Pickerley, Amber Rudd and Claire Renders, thank you so much. It's been another brilliant discussion. And we'll do one next week too. So have a good week. Thank you very much. Thanks to the panel.